Now, concerning friends, I must state that it is well and good to have them, as long as one does not have yourself along with them. For oftentimes, when one makes a friend of any sort, one changes one's own way of doing things as well. And often this is because in those early stages of friendship, both parties feel it necessary to cloak themselves in sundry divertissements and so on. Having already stated my affections towards parties, I herein state that this type of friendship I do not care for at all, for it takes far too much work. You seem to start a cycle of roles, wherein the first change in behaviors results in a similar change in humors in the other party, and that change changes the next change as well as the previous one, so forth and so on, ad infinitum. In short, the type of friend who pretends to be someone you're not, I don't really care for at all. I find people who pretend to be something that they're not so tiring and beleaguered that it would be quite an endeavor indeed to sustain any sort of communications with them. Such falsehood is not acceptable, unacceptable, really. I do not pretend to be something that I'm not. I pretend to be something that I am. Perhaps that is why it feels so good. That reminds me of failing. The joy of failing is very joyous. There's nothing like having nothing to do after you failed at something. You don't have to try anymore, if you don't want to, that is. And it's very liberating, too. The satisfaction one gets from failing is unequaled by tennis balls. There's never a sharp moment when it comes like that, and yes, sir, how it is to be cherished. Like a square with writing written inside of it in a foggy afternoon, and you can't quite make out what it says because it's too foggy. Or maybe you just need new glasses, or glasses in the first place. Or you need to get rid of glasses, or you need a BLT on rye with a smidgen, or is it smidgen, of pickled mustard on the side, slightly grilled but not sautéed, and a deep hollandaise and Worcestershire blend sauce with a snip of parsley for garnish, maybe two or three twigs at most, with a half-filled glass of lemon meringue pie blended and pureed with three crescent ice cubes, and a straw, which normally accompanies a juice box of fruit medley, or is it punch, in the 6.75-ounce box, instead of the usual 354 milliliters, all served on a red and white checkered napkin obtained from a local Mexican-American restaurant, which normally serves quesadillas on Friday, except this Friday, the head chef was taken ill because he walked outside in the sun with an umbrella and a toucan and usually eats prawn chips when he visits the corner grocery, but on the Friday before the Friday when the head chef was taken ill because he walked outside with the sun with an umbrella and the toucan was not in the mood for prawn chips because it knew that there was no such thing as prawns, so certainly it was quite impossible to make prawn chips, but later began to correct and rectify its error because it realized that prawns do exist, so prawn chips are free to exist as well, but by this time it was the Tuesday after the Friday before the Friday when the head chef walked outside in the sun with an umbrella and the toucan, so the toucan could not receive the prawn chips which it normally received at the corner grocery, so it was out of luck for that particular week because the little baby whose mother usually sells hamburger patties at the corner grocery decided to walk for the very first time. So its mother was so excited that it decided not to sell hamburger patties at the corner grocery, but instead go out for film because a camera which she wanted to use to take pictures of her baby's first walkings only had one picture left, the other pictures being used to take pictures of the snow person building contest at the local park that preceding January. The very same week that the head chef bought the umbrella, which he took out along with the toucan on the Friday. After the Friday, the toucan did not eat any prawn chips because it questioned the existence of prawns. And so, she decided to go and get some more film at the local photography, jewelry, and candy store, which recently added a jewelry section that same preceding January that the mother of the baby who accompanies its mother to the corner market where she sells hamburger patties, or someone who knew the mother of the baby who accompanies its mother to the corner market where she sells hamburger patties and has access to her camera and would have been allowed to take all the pictures on the roll of the film but one, or at least would think it has that type of permission, took all the pictures but one on the roll that was in the camera that the mother of the baby who accompanies its mother to the corner market where she sells hamburger patties wanted to take the pictures of the baby's first walkings, but the photography, jewelry, and candy shop was closed because a lady who runs the shop went to the opening of another photography, jewelry, and candy shop in Bermuda, whose owner happened to get the idea of opening the photography, jewelry, and candy shop from the very same woman whose photography, jewelry, and candy shop recently opened its jewelry section, the woman having discussed this with her soon-to-be colleague in Bermuda some months before the recent opening, which occurred on the Friday before the head chef took ill because he was walking outside in the sun with an umbrella and the toucan. But the Bermudan shop whose grand opening the owner of the photography, jewelry, and candy shop had closed her store for was closed as well because the owner of the Bermudan photography, jewelry, and candy shop was involved in an interesting game of euchre, which had taken several unfortunate turns and ended up with the fall of a bitter Scotch factory owner. Also involved in the game of euchre, which occurred on the Friday before the Friday of the opening of the jewelry section of the photography, jewelry, and candy store, which the mother of the baby whose mother accompanies it to the corner market where she sells hamburger patties had wanted to go to replace the roll of film taken all up except one by the snow person building contest at the local park that preceding January. But later it was discovered that there was no such thing as Bitterscotch, and so there could be no Bitterscotch factory, and so there could be no Bitterscotch factory owner. And so the owner could not have suffered a fall, which was the final in a series of unfortunate events which happened after the unfortunate game of unfortunate euchre, which also involved the owner of the Bermudan Photography, Jewelry, and Candy Shop, whose store's opening was closed because the whole Bitterscotch scotch problem, which had been long and hardly worked at by the fellow players of the euchre game, and which was only being solved after roughly 3,600 days by the yellow canary trainer, who was also in attendance at the unfortunate euchre unfortunate game. So the owner of the Bermudan Photography Jewelry and Candy Store, being troubled with this problem long after the opening day, was forced to close his shop. But really, I suppose you wouldn't need that napkin to complete the ensemble anyhow. I next thought, I suppose that the whole thing wouldn't really come in handy for seeing the writing inside the square with the writing inside it. Maybe you just need to rub your hands over your eyes. Close them first, of course, to clarify your vision and then take another look at it. And if you can't see it after all that, then I suppose it wasn't all that important to look at in the first place. Take a pack of playing cards, for example. You ever look at a card up close? I mean right up close to the shape of it. You know that most cards have rounded corners, not even beveled, but rounded, real smoothly. I wonder, in the playing card factory, what do they do with those card corners? Do they take a bunch of card corners and make a card corner card out of it, or do they just do something else? That would be really interesting to get a card corner card. A person can take pride in that sort of thing. A person should take pride in that sort of thing. You wouldn't want to be dealt a card corner card in a game of solitaire and not say something about it. Even if it would ruin the hand for you, it would be unseemly not to at least mention such a thing, like a partridge or getting older. As a person approaches the closing of that person's life, a certain aura of satisfaction envelops that person. This is what makes the end of a thing most spectacular, especially if one is visited by all the friends one has made along the way. And then one smirks at it and says, I'll be a jack-o'-lantern or something else. Barnacles clinging to the sides of the hulls of ships often have the same problem. Disattachment is the ideal which motivates most things in existence. So towards the closing of existence, one feels compelled to shout out at the top of lungs jolly places which one has often frequented and holidays which often approach during the different times of the year. But these things are not compared to everything else. So then it's all right, in the end, or the beginning. New Year's has to be one of my selections for favorite holiday of the year, partially because it's not confined to one year, but mostly because you can never tell when it is. I mean, you know when it is, but you can't tell by looking around or outside the window or in the faces of people. Like at 11 o'clock on New Year's Eve, it's exact perfect silence. Nothing seems to be going on, which is certainly terrific considering that many things are in fact going on. I suppose this silence is the only clue we get. You really have no time to prepare for it, which is another plus, because there's nothing really to do to prepare except write it out. Perhaps that's why it's so quiet. People always like a struggle, but when there's nothing going on, nothing is going on. That's why I think people like to make their ideals the most opposite and contradictory of their present situations as they can. Because once they've been attained, there's no thing or things left to struggle with or for or on. So tyrants and others are permissible because we don't want them to be. Maybe that's something to do with Jesus. I could be wrong, but that seemed like a fairly good guess if I was forced to make one, which I am. Rebels are always looked up upon, even if we look up by looking down, even if we look down by looking sideways, even if we look sideways by looking with our eyelids tightly shut. I always have appreciated a circle of lined up dominoes because the last one falls on the fallen first one. Most people meet the end of things very sociably and passively saying, etc., etc. Those moments are beautiful, so me and the hummers are very agreeable like that. Beautiful things rarely escape us, so we must hum about them. I still feel very guilty being generous. People think that I'm being nice whenever I give them money. Little do they realize that I want to get rid of money. I'm actually very selfish, preferring to unload on them the hassles and the anguish. Poor souls, they think I'm generous. I'm looking out for me, which is the polite thing to do, after all is said and done, wasted away and regurgitated to come back to beneficence again. I'd rather be rid of everything. In the long run, it works out far better that way. Just eat some bugs, maybe, and live in peace. Peace and ease sound similar, I think. Remember in all those comedic things where the people fight and then kiss each other? Often in those sorts of things, there is a peripheral sidekick to one or both of the others who is quite the loser. He rarely wins, and when he does, he has to return his win for store credit only because it doesn't work the way she would like it to. When I write he and she, I mean the same person, but sometimes a sidekick loser is a she, and sometimes it's a he, so I'll switch back and forth like that on occasion. Don't pay too much attention to that. So the loser sidekick is there, being a loser, offering losing advice, making losing jokes, and then at the end he finds another loser and they kiss in the end too. That's what I don't like at all. I understand if the two original idiots want to do that, but the loser should have more sense and non-idiocy than that. I guess everything has to be wrapped up with a bow in order for people to open it, so they can return it for store credit only. That's why I'm glad that I'll be the greatest loser in the history of the world. I get tingles just thinking about it, so I'll stop. One of the keys to life and things that resemble it is to do things. To truly, really do things and have a clear plan about it and follow through to the end that is most probable. And if one cannot do it, then not doing it is doing something too, in which case this has been fulfilled. And once something has been done, it is equally important to stop and go on to the next thing to be done and complete that. In this way, life and things that resemble it progresses and does not recede, like the gums of a person with gingivitis. People love to fight something that is their equal, that is their opposite in every way, that has a cause that is the opposite of their cause and eats ponies from head to hoof instead of from hoof to head. But when what they are fighting has no cause, no purpose, that is an enemy to be unepisted. And they succeed. They always succeed. They are very courteous for succeeding. But they stoop up before they stop up, and in their stooping is the middle, the disquieting middle without a middle. And then you have won, simply because you lost. You know when someone stands stock still with their hands just lying idle at their side, standing in a prone position without posed appendages or posture? That's really annoying. Also meeting new people, that's that too. And then you have to remember their names or what you talked about every single time you talk to them, and you have to keep an eye out for them if you're walking along and you happen to bump into them. I wish everyone could be new people, people you only have to talk to once and then they disappear so you don't have to pretend to know who they are. That'd be nice, like hearing a song which you've forgotten the words to, or the music, or both. Can there be words without music? Of course there can, what a silly question to ask. Music is the best when it's without words, or when you can't understand what the singer is saying. Or maybe with the words it makes more sense. You never can tell, so please don't. When wearing gloves, if you are the sort of person to wear gloves around, should the situation and the externals warrant it, which it seems you are, here is something quite satisfactory that you should do. If you have gloves with separate fingers, which, if I have my terminology correct, is what distinguishes gloves from mittens, therefore if you wear gloves, by definition they have separate fingers, then you should take your fingers out of them and hold your hand in a fist-like position. This way, there will be no fingers in the glove. But nobody else knows that, so you can pretend like you do have fingers in the glove. You can mannerize all you want with your hands, and it will seem like your gloves really do have fingers in their fingers. And when you are waving your glove fingers about, they feel so flimsy without any real fingers in them, it's quite delightful. And then, if people catch on, I don't know how possibly they would, but they may just may, after all is done and said, then you can pretend to be pretending not to have any fingers in your fingers, and you'll do it that way. And they'll say, why are you having your hands in a fist-like position again, you? I cannot understand why you keep on going about doing that all the time, and you think that nobody is the wiser, but I am the wiser, yes I am, yes I am the wiser. And then you can say, yes, you have got me there, I was pretending all along. And they will believe you, unless they is a she or a he or any sort of an individual they. But as long as they are they, you can pretend to pretend, and they will think that you are only pretending, which is very truthful of them and all wrong. But you will make believe that it's right. And that is a quite enjoyable occupation that one can perform with gloves. But your gloves require fingers, and you require fingers, and there are too many requirements ultimately to make it very thirsty. But it is rather funny, don't you think? If you don't, I suggest you get mittens, or cut the fingers off your gloves so that you won't be reminded of it, then throw the scissors in the river, then throw the river in another bigger river, and then let it go and eat a sandwich or another easily transportable food item which you brought along in a small plastic bag inside a paper bag just for the purpose of nourishment after the river throwing in another bigger river. And then the nutrients from that sandwich will inspire you to a possible thought, which will remain somewhere in your brain for as long as it's there, which could be an especially long time, depending on what I meant by it in the it's in the middle part of this sentence. So ultimately, it would be better to perform these instructions than not to perform them, so that you can have no further thought about the business about which I gave the instructions. I believe it had something to do with mittens of one variety or another. If you remember it, be sure to forget it, and then let me know. But not before you let yourself unknow. Remember the partridge? Yeah, great. Like a found generation, given all its values and conclusions by its predecessors, urging upon its counterpart some new discovery when all has been discovered, echoing futility like a small digital clock in the corner of a screen constantly displaying 6:13. Nothing to look forward to, because looking has become a punishment for the achievements of the formers. Always a dead end of success, sometimes a found cause, never a lost one. Stuck recycling the these. And so they tumble as if magnets on the equator, lost in the anti-vacuum of knowledge and acknowledging. Everything has been handed, nothing footed, nothing shaky, not even the shakiness itself. And crocodiles don't really have a smile. Their teeth are always like that. Some people just pretend that a smile is having teeth exposed, but it's more than that. It's having the briars of the rationalities rooted out and zipped in a small white plastic bag with a yellow plastic handle, like on a trash bag, but not a trash bag. A bag not even designed for trash, even if it had been designed instead of mentioned off the cuff by you. So really, that forces you into a kind of position. What are you doing to do about that? I know, but I will not tell, for I would like you to come to it yourself, thinking-wise. And if you do that, then you will know what I am doing now and why it is so utterly enjoyablenity. But not until then, so perhaps you shall wait. Or perhaps you have already found it. Though those two perhapses were one, they would be too much perhaps-ish for any decent meal, so we depart from this as from a solemnly breezing banner of a thing. How about that? Yes, sir. Now, there be certain fellows and fellowesses who hamper on and on about nothing but moderation. To them, I think thus, that if moderation is a solution to everything, then shouldn't we all practice moderation in practicing moderation? Therefore, in order to truly believe in the power of moderation all the time, one must not always believe in the power of moderation all the time. For if all cases were to be ruled by moderation, then there would be no moderation, as far as moderation were concerned, at least. Therefore, moderation must be used moderationally if it is to practice itself in the reflexive case, for once the reflexive has been confirmed, then one may extrapolate outwards towards other things, that is to say, things that do not have to do with moderation. To continue, one must practice moderation only sometimes if one is to practice moderation. In order to make up for times past, which I, rightly or readily, assume have been in aforementioned practice, it is necessary to install a general prohibition on aforementioned until some kind of aforementioned has been achieved in actuality, the actuality mentioned 2 words ago, 7 words ago now, that is to say. If discontinuance counts for prohibition, then we may accept the undeniably acceptable fact that aforementioned is once again several, though not 2, 7 words away. Keeping track is not nearly so easy as disinheriting bunglers' errands, which come up surprisingly randomly, despite all that all have to do about them in their minds and conceptions. But that's okay. I suppose if one wants to be technical about it, and why should one not want to be technical about it, for technicality is always and will always be cherished so long as there is cherishing, and technicality, of course, then one would have to write conceptions instead of conceptions, but that way has long been absent and scattered amongst the four winds. Though there are more than four winds. That is a fact, and there's nothing everyone can do about it. Not even anyone, or no one, can do anything about it. Then when, just before the rain comes, and there is a very, very strong wind, you can lean right up against the wind, and, if you trust it enough, it feels like you're leaning against a liquid wall, except that it's the wind. Then after a while, you have to put one of your feet back to not fall over, but in that course of seconds, it's all in the wind, and you're just leaning against it, while everybody else, if there is everybody else, is fighting against it. If you just lean up against something, usually it will lean right back against you, unless it's not there, that is. But since that would really be quite foolish, then we can assume that that will never happen. Who would want to lean against nothing? I suppose nobody would, but nobody hasn't figured into things in a long time, and it would be pitiful for nobody to start up again now. So time given to leaning is time given to being leant upon, which is not so frank a thing if you don't think about it for a while. No, sir. So let's do that. But let us definitely not do putting other people's clothes on. Even if you're borrowing a hat or a sock, no matter how you justify it to yourself, you, that is to say I, can never get used to putting something on that others have had put on in the past. It's almost traumatic. You start thinking about the most uninteresting things, like what the person was doing while in the clothing items, and what they were thinking and seeing while in the aforementioned raiment. Then you start imagining that you actually are that person and not just wearing various articles belonging to them. The whole fiasco really is a fiasco. It's better just to have your own clothes and not worry about that sort of thing. That way, if you do start thinking in that line of things, then it will be all right, because it will be you and not somebody else. You think so, at least. Though I do get awfully worried about you, something terrible, sometimes. If I want to share something sometime else, I can easily do so with myself. But you, not having myself, nor even being myself, will have no one. You will be dark and secluded and bashful and frightened and stuck in a Ferris wheel without a large sledgehammer but with a goldfish. Stuck. Stung, studied, studying, stull, indistupendous, and unhopelessly phrasing unencourageable lectures without a handy pronunciation key. So don't do that anymore. I would also appreciate an end to all this car crash business. It seems that the only thing that can happen to individuals in cars is crashing. In a book, for example, if someone's going down a road, odds are with them that the car that they are riding in will crash. Why can't people drive their cars without crashing into things? You don't see people walking crashing into anything. And there's yet another benefit to walking, and also to humming. Non-car crashing is also very suited to that, or versa vice, or vice versa, vice or versa. Interesting choice. Despite my leaning, something tells me that I'd go with versa. Though no one knows what they will do until they do it, or don't do it as the case may be, or may not be. Living on the precipice of depression like that, it is rather awkward to discover small objects in your pockets. So many concerns. Though I do not want it to be understood that I don't want anybody to worry about me. Nobody should worry about me either, and the same goes for anybody and somebody. You can pass along to all the Elses and personages you happen to meet, too. I don't want anyone, and the rest of the lately mentioned company, to be doing something or a thing which I won't do myself. If I don't see what is so significant about worrying, what is the use of everyone else, besides everyone and me, worrying? There's no point to it. It's not that there are a lot more things to worry about in the world, because there aren't. It's just that the whole activity along those lines is too worrisome, busysome, and bothersome to become preoccupied and a goose over. There is one main difference between dumb persons and smart persons. Dumb persons don't know anything. Smart persons don't know anything, but they develop a very complex terminology to hide it, covering the in-knowledge with a lot of words. I am a dumb person, though sometimes, usually sometimes, I can be exemplarily smart. like when something unexpected but hidden piles on you and the underneath of your brain seems to fold underneath itself, twirling your vision inside out and maybe with an almost unnoticeably brief period of unconsciousness experiencing. Or maybe you're just sleepy. Yes, like that. Yes, like that, that. But I like allergies. All of the symptoms of a cold with none of the psychological underpinnings. I wish I had more of them, or everyone else had less, or everyone else had more, but then I'd get a double helping of the more and more allergies so that I'd still have more when everyone else did. Or vice versa. A fairly large amount of people sneeze. That gets me thinking about how if everyone was in nature, nobody would like it. It's a good thing we're in civilization, then. Some of the times, at least. But not like a partridge. No, nothing like it. But instead, something not quite completely overtly underlike, yet not unlike, and with pieces of goo in the center, that old birthday feeling. Or should it be that new birthday feeling? Or should it be hairy men rubbing sandpaper, which I am strongly considering calling sanding, if not for the uninhibited gloominess of the word and for the other stuff, on other pieces of sandpaper until both pieces, remember, it's one piece of sandpaper being rubbed on another, so although there are many men at this task, I think it only proper to announce it as two pieces. Otherwise, the other way around, we lose the individualness in the collective activity, which makes it such an enthusiastic gem of an activity-making event, no longer resembles sandpaper at all, but are just two pieces of paper, so the activity, remember that we called it an activity before, can no longer be termed sanding, reference to that hitherto referenced word can be recalled hithertoly, but rather papering, which has none of the qualities before mentioned of sanding, but which retains a certain something as a keepsake on the inside pocket in a pair of pants unevenly but neatly folded in the third from the bottom, which is also the seventh from the top drawer in a collection of drawers, commonly called by most a bureau, but which is labeled by this particular owner as switch off my boiling container of machines fart soaked all last evening and then the morning in the substance commonly called water, but which you, and by this you I mean not you, know as sandwich jelly stuffed in an engine inside a vanity overly sized sock, and there are little animals in there too. Oh, watch the little animals. I think one of them is a rabbit, but it may be a burly small man with just the right amount of hands to mistake himself for a rabbit, so much so that he believes himself a rabbit, and his invisible wife does too, though they never really got married because the wife ran off and the preacher could see her then, so the preacher knew she wasn't there, and then dried for several more days in what I call the sun, and then shown a picture of a plus sign to get the consistency just right, and bacon. But maybe it's just the birthday spirit in some and the spirit of birthdays in others. Because it all matters a great deal which way things go about, before seeing about the going about them, but only after the farewelling and naysaying contributes to a proper spirit of camaraderie and ne'er-do-wellicitude with a dash of paper. The way I figure it, which incidentally is the only way it can be figured, is that since you're going to be bad at something, either directly or indirectly, anyway, you might as well be bad at something. Because if you aren't bad at something, then someone else, imitating your contribution or contributions or contributions to society, will ultimately do a rather poor job of it. And even if they don't, someone will. Sometime. Let's say that someone just happens to do a good job of emulating you the first time out of the gate. But then that offers two chances instead of one for possible future bad imitations. Let's say even that a whole lot of people do good at doing good by you. Probability is a probability, after all. And you have started a school of some sort or another. Then you really have a bunch of eggs in a seltzer bottle. Because that's just so many more opportunities to do a shabby job of it. And someone, eventually, always does a shabby job of it. I'm awfully proud of that dependency myself. So, it being inevitable that even if your own work is not bad, bad work will ultimately come to be because of your name anyway, you might as well save everyone else the trouble and do the bad work yourself. That's responsibility, after all. Do the bad of your own unfree will and get it over with, quickly and without much fuss. Of course, there is the respectable and virtuous way out of this whole dilemma, which is not having any contact with someone so that no one copies you no matter what, good or bad, you do. But that is really hard to do, as you can't keep track of those early years when nothing memorable occurs, but during which, nevertheless, bad things may be produced. But since nobody rarely, if ever, remembers these years, you have to do bad later on in order to be positively sure. But once that is out of the way, everything returns to itself, of course, and that's very good. But little imperfections are all right. In fact, I find them almost necessary to experience anything. When seeing lots of water fall over something or a greater amount of it going around in ripples and extending to another place, for example, it adds a little something, and probably more, if there is something not exactly right. You can say then, at least I am very nauseous, or thank so-and-so that there is a little speck of dust in my eye or my eyelash blocking my vision ever so slightly. Then it is something. But these little imperfections, of course, must be natural and purely contained in one's body. It would not make any sense at all if it were music in the ears or something else blocking out the all-aroundiness or some such like. Just some little thing, small hither or thither, and it adds something grand and accidental in a nice sort of way, of course. And all the time it is like this. And it's me, Jimmy Aristotle, though it's just Jimmy to you. So it is.